that I couldn't stand would be to have a new building, a new styling building go up at Oakland that looked like the old brick plant that was behind me. And our location was out from the plant, separated from it, near a highway, so that anyone driving by would see our building and see the other one. And what I really wanted was to sort of duplicate the brick, color brick that we had at the Tech Center, because that looked absolutely different than anything at all. And I also like the idea of using some aluminum fillers. And so we developed the design of the building using this color brick and using the aluminum fillers, and talking with the Opal people, they said, we don't know where you can get that. So the next weekend, my wife and I went out into Wiesbaden, which is a nearby city, and just looked around at the new buildings. And here is a building made of this beautiful yellow brick, colored brick, with aluminum fillers up the side. It was there all the time, but this fellow had never seen it.
Wiesbaden was about 10 miles away.
10 miles, 15 miles. So early the next morning, I got a hold of the Opal man. Do it. That's it. They did. And we had developed this building with enough space for the individual studios, an auditorium inside, and an outside auditorium, all with turntables that rotated and push buttons, and office, separate office space, and a fountain room in the front. And it was very simple. And they, I think it was the fastest construction job I ever saw. Because once they get the direction and make up their mind that they're going to go, they go fast.
Did they do a good job? What about the interior in terms of the latest wrinkles and styling? I mean, how did you put them?
Well, we got a lot of help from the States in getting. Some equipment takes a long time to build. So we actually got complete equipment from the States. But we also found places in Europe that made turntables. You know, there's a way to get things and have the people that are familiar with it. And certainly the Opal people had a lot of strength in getting things. They had a lot of power. After we had the building built, it would be 1963 if we all done it. People from all over Europe came to see it. This was the first styling or design building that they had ever seen. So the different companies sent their representatives to have a look.
And as visitors,
a lot of things we couldn't show them, but at least we could show them how it operated.
We can show these
big opening ceremonies. Magazines, Stern magazine, which is their kind of light magazine, big article magazine. And along with the space for our styling building was a space for a few other buildings. There was a space lobby for an engineering building. In about 3 years they built that, which had the same kind of brick. General Construction was our styling building, but of course it was much bigger because they had a larger staff. Building more computers nearby. So we had our own little tech center.
The new condos and the diplomat,
updated the styling of the Record first, and that really started to move along well. And the and then from that we developed the Commodore, and that went pretty well for a while. And at the same time we brought out an all new Cadet, which was increased in size of the
quite the box.
That's the one that we brought over to this country. So,
yes.
And to combat the family car, no excitement reputation of Opel, we brought out the Opel Rally car and encouraged outside people to rebuild those cars and rallies. Successful. They are today. They're still running.
These are not sport cars.
Production cars.
Production
cars, but with higher performance engines and chassis and so on. And that's part of the reason I got Tony Lupino was to help out in this respect. L-I-P-I-N-E. He is now design chief for Porsche. L-I-P-I-N-E. Well, he was an engineer and he was a sports car aficionado.
Okay.
So he fell right into that thing.
And he did his thing.
You know, he enjoyed taking some production cars and putting all this nice equipment on. And we'd do all this right in the styling building. We didn't ask anybody for anything. And he would take them out and put them on the racetrack. Also, he would talk to people in Switzerland, or from Sweden, Eklund. He would set up high-performance cars. So somehow, some money found a way into his pocket from Opel to do these things. Now, these were in the days when, over here, you couldn't do that sort of thing, so we didn't talk about it. Well, he had been doing this for Opel dealers.
Okay.
So we just encouraged that a little bit. And as a result, they started winning rallies all over Europe. And that kind of puts Opel in a different light. Well, about this time, I started thinking about a special car. First of all, we'll try to get it in the Frankfurt show, which is seen by people from all over the world.
It's the
Frankfurt Auto Show. And and what developed out of that was a sports car. And as soon as I suggested a sports car, and I'm talking just about our own styling area, I'm not talking about anybody outside, because we didn't tell them. A lot of people said, well, that's not our business. Should make sports cars. We shouldn't be in that kind of business.
Say,
some of the people in my own department, my assistant, and some others were rather cool with the idea, and others were enthusiastic.
Did you report to the assistant?
No. I had the man who was formerly running the department for Mearsheimer as my assistant. And he's a fine fellow. Carl Maeger, M-A-E-G-E-R. And he was cool to it. That was just the way he felt. He was honest about it.
Was it family car?
Yeah, that's part of it. So we're in the car, in the business of making cars for the butcher and the baker and candlestick maker. But anyway, we went ahead and worked on it. Most of all, didn't know about it. And developed it until the time that we had a full-size plaster bottle. Well, about this time, Fred Donner was coming over for another visit. And we had gotten a schedule of the places that he was going to visit. The first place he was going to visit was our place. At 8:30 in the morning, Fred Donner is going to show up. So the night before, I called Nelson Stark, our general manager, managing director, and I said, Nelson, Mr. Donner is coming over here tomorrow morning, and there's something that I feel that I ought to show you before we leave the house.
Yeah, you need to consider from the
because he didn't know about sports cars. And if you don't ask anybody, nobody says no. So I wanted to complete it to the point where there was something to see physically. So
yeah, full-size clay.
Full-size clay and plaster one. I couldn't conceal it because Fred Donner's coming in for a visit. No way could I. I didn't want to. Besides. So I got Nelson Stark over there at 7 in the morning to look at these things. I think internally he's saying, well, it looks all right, but I wonder what Mr. Donner's going to say. But he agreed to it. Well, we'll show it to him.
Okay.
And I was showing this at the time, not as a production car, just as a show car.
A special sports car?
Yes, that became a GT.
Okay.
And it was not far from today's GT. So he had agreed to show it. Nor did I, because we hadn't gotten to that point yet. But as a show car, he's used to show cars, he understands it. So we crossed that bridge over.
He was low this time.
Yeah, he was, somebody was. Anything in the sporty car lineup is his bigger because he's the guy that put Pontiac on that. So I talked to him about some of the problems I was having with our sales manager and others who were not enthusiastic about this because they're changing over his image. An everyday workhorse to a sporty car. Public relations.
Early marketing.
Yeah, market research. And he mentioned that too. Of course, everybody was enthusiastic, you know?
Can you describe it? Just a good point to describe the car?
turned out that we generally felt that the best thing to build this from has got to be based on some production car to be economically feasible. We'll need to base it on the cadet. We talked about basing it on the Record or the cadet. So we ended up with that. The wheelbase would have to be changed. The engine location should be changed. And I've got a little story on that. It was to be as low as we could get it, but still have the people inside. And it was to be aerodynamic, sealed headlights, luggage space. Similarities between the Corvette and this car. Because I worked on both cars. But, the headlights on most cars just flip up. But on this car, it rotates. That had a 1 liter engine and a 1.9 liter engine. And this was sold both ways, but they sold almost no 1 liter engines. They wanted to have that for a price that probably not a good idea. Nobody bought it.
Really?
Hard to get out of its own way. And even the 1.9 was not making a hot performance. But our original intention was to take the 1.9 engine and put it in a higher compression. This is thanks to the preparation. Car like the GT. He was asking the sales manager, how many do you suppose we can sell? And the sales manager, his name was Schnabel, S-C-H-N-A-B-E-L, said, oh, I think maybe you can sell 2,000 or 3,000. Several more thousand in the States. But he didn't like it. So why was he going to say you could sell more? Especially when we were bringing out other new cars, and the engineering department was loaded, and they didn't know where to turn to get more. There's an interesting story on there. the location. We in design styling, mobile styling, had always felt that the engine must be brought back from the cadet location. The cadet location is way up in the front. And we wanted to bring it back to 7 or 8 inches and 9 inches. And the engineering department, when they heard about this, they said, oh, we don't have the engineering time to do all this. We must take the cadet car the way it is and just put the shell on it. Time I had a few people in the organization very closely. One of them was Bob Lutz, was the
Chrysler,
and he at that time was an assistant to the general manager. In other words, he had just gotten over from New York and he was in a fairly low position. But he was an enthusiast. Convince people,
but
you put in two mules.
Yeah.
They look like the same car, but they weren't. Look at them on the outside, you wouldn't know which is which. And so we had these cars completed and took them to Nürburgring, racetrack. N-U-R-B-U-R-G-R-I-N-G, some well known racetrack. Enthusiastic one way or the other. He said, well, you know, maybe the one with the engine back is better, but maybe the customer went over there. So Bob Lutz got a hold of Hans Herrmann, who was a noted old-time racetrack H-E-R-R-M-A-N-N. And they went out to the track, and Bob rode with them, both cars. And Hans Herrmann came back and said, there's no comparison. Absolutely, you must build the one with the engine to the rear. And that message was delivered to the managing director and the chief engineer. And that's the way.
What's the criteria for
the way they
handle it? The way they handle it.
Put the engine forward, nose dives on all the cars.
Most of them. What type of suspension?
Basically. See, the problem that engineering had was that they didn't have the manpower to do a lot of engineering on the GT and the new record and the new and all those things at the same time. So as a result, a lot of that engineering time was farmed out to a French company. Brisson and Lutz, B-R-I-S-S, play that, that's right, B-R-I-S-S-A-N. Shipped it back to Bochum, where the car was assembled.
I'm just looking at the
eventually, Renault or somebody took over that plant, so they were forced to show people were just a mile deep. They couldn't believe it. Opel? Building a car like this?
Stagio Opel.
Yeah. And that was just one more thing that changed our image.
What reaction did you get from the
Well, it could have been, you know, if we had gotten a more powerful engine, then we'd change the suspension and change the transmission and all this. It could have been a more serious car.
So as far as stability and performance, it's fine. You've got an underpowered engine.
Well, before you say underpowered engine, we were competing with other cars, like the MG cars in that category. And that's more. We were competitive with them for acceleration. No German companies. Our intentions were right. We intended to be competitive, but more competitive with them, unfortunately.
So, after the Frankfurt show, I think.
What after the Frankfurt show? Very serious about building the car. We're getting problems. You know, it was after the Frankfurt show, they got a serious opinion of the engineering of the car for production. And who was going to build it? Because our manufacturing hands are not going to do it. It was almost over his dead body that we purchased the body elsewhere. They were in this country and not so much in Germany. We only had a lot of people who believed what some of our people believed. Opel was not in the sports car business, and therefore it didn't have the reputation that Porsche had in their environment. I doubt that they were far off.
Well, that's Porsche.
I left in 67, so the car wasn't even out yet on the market for us when I left in office. And then Chuck Jordan took over, and they had to make a few minor revisions before it came out of production. And then he eventually left. I think it was Dave Bowles that was there. The name carried on, and some of the succeeding people built new prototypes, but it never got into production.
What
happened? Well, the reason they used is that the plant that they were using for cranks was being used for other vehicles. They didn't want to build it. I feel myself that they could have found an answer to that.
They
said, I have been told,
yeah,
that the French plant said we could I would think that if they wanted to, they could have found somebody else to build.
It must be very frustrating to you at that point that something you shepherded through with a great deal of style and dispatch took so long coming to fruition.
Well, of course, that's frustrating. But there was very little I could do about it. They did quite a lot of work on it. I don't mean that they didn't do any work on engineering. They did a lot.
Right.
But they couldn't handle the total job.
Okay. They couldn't handle the body.
And I guess probably he was right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was just trying to duck it because he'd always been for the project.
Yeah, that was Hans Mercer.
Yeah.
Yeah. He did it on your side from the beginning.
Yeah, he did.
But his production people said we didn't have the space or the capacity for it.
It was both engineering and production were having difficulties because Opel's volume was very high by this time. It had it had changed tremendously.
It had really taken off with the new models.
Yeah.
Yeah, very popular. So this was outside the mainstream of the company's production.
Oh, yeah.
And they'd have to find a line for it.
Yeah, and it was not a high profit venture, but it was high in image profit.
Certainly by this time, racing had become enormously popular. Both in this country, both abroad and then in this country.
Yeah, at every Nürburgring race where they have really high-powered race cars, there would be other races, some of them just Opel Kadetts.
Mm-hmm.
So we were, you know, building up the image of Opel considerably in this area.
Right. You must have had meetings with various with the managing director, assistant managing director, and others saying this is to our advantage. We really should try and capitalize on it.
Oh yeah.
They would say, well, what can we do? Something like that.
Yeah, I guess that's the way you'd put it. They were, you know, in the meetings they were sympathetic towards our goals, and they had the same goals. They wanted to improve the image of Opel. But they felt their hands were a little bit tied by the lack of manpower in certain areas. And
when you say manpower, you mean skilled laborers?
No, I'm talking about engineering manpower and production manpower also.
What was the problem?
Maybe the problem was that we were increasing our number of cars so much, and our sales were increasing. You can't call that a problem.
No, but I mean, what was the situation in terms of the lack of skilled manpower? You couldn't hire them, or they weren't available?
Well, I guess they weren't available. I don't know if you know anything about the situation in Germany at that time, but
that's what I mean. What was the situation?
There are so many of their workers are from foreign countries.
That's right.
Manpower
being decimated by the war.
Yes.
Yes.
And then some Germans really don't want to work in certain areas, but you can get Turks and Greeks and Yugoslavian people,
right,
and Spaniards and so on.
Which they did. Great.
They would do anything to make some money.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would send people into these countries and lure people to come to Germany.
Right.
And alone, if they're married, they just come and they live for a year and they send money back to their wives and family. And I don't know what percentage of our workforce was other than German. That's a tremendous number. And at one time, they spoke as many as 30 languages. How they handled it, I don't know.
Even in the 60s?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I think maybe more then than now.
They cut it way back.
I think some has been cut back some. But a tremendous number of people from Southern Europe and Northern Africa are living in Germany. As guest workers, they call them.
Yeah.
Guest Arbeiters.
Yeah. sort of a semi, a lower class citizen, I suspect. They get work permits for that citizen.
Yeah. But they have certain rights under German law, so it, you know, it's not totally that.
Yeah, not persons. So, you've been there, what, 3 years now?
Well, from time to, originally when we went over there, Bill said, well, this will be for at least 2 years, because he didn't know,
right.
And he didn't want people to go over there and stay, and I didn't want to go over there and stay, but that was all right. So it came 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and several times Bill would make some noises about coming back. Well, finally, after I've been there 5.5 years, he said, all right, I think it's time you came back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, what do you, you wanted to send Chuck Jordan over. And, you know, this is a great way to learn. Because when I was there, I was into things that I would never be involved in the States.
Right. Yeah.
I'm a car designer by trade. But I went over there and I became involved in advertising, in manufacturing, engineering, sales. I attended the same meetings that they attended to. I heard all the same stuff. So you see a much larger picture.
Right.
And it was terrific.
I bet it was very exciting.
And we had our own little internal organization that most people didn't know about, of a few guys, which we called the Too Many Cooks Club. And we only had our own little insignia. And this was myself and Bob Lutz and Clayton Leach, who was assistant chief engineer in American.
W-A-C-H.
Yeah, and Bill DeLong, D-E-L-O-N-G, who was a finance guy. So we had a man in almost every category. And if I needed help in different areas, I knew who to go to. Who would be sympathetic?
Right. Yeah.
And this is such a help.
Yes. Tell us a bit about Bob Lutz. He's been the most visible member of your crew. Was he sort of a protege of yours?
No.
He'd been sent over by
Well, he had been, you know, he's Swiss.
That's what I understand, yeah.
And during the war, his father was in Boston, I believe, during the war.
Mm-hmm.
He was raised there. And then went back after the war, and then Bob, I guess, stayed over here, and he joined the Marine Corps. He was a flyer in the Korean War. And then after the war, he's an automobile lover, from the word go. He joined General Motors in New York. And then shortly after that, they sent him to Germany.
Was he in sales?
He was sent over there as an assistant to the managing director.
Right. He recognized his potential at that time.
And he's, in my book, he knows considerable about engineering, and he has a knack for design to understand the problems and so on.
Right, processes.
And he knows sales. A little bit, and knew a little bit, knows a lot now. Also is smart enough to know something about finance. You know, he's a pretty clever guy.
Yes.
And he's very aggressive.
He spoke German fluently there.
Spoke German fluently.
Very aggressive.
Schweizer Deutsch. A little bit of French. And English like an American. So, when he was over there, he progressed quite rapidly. And he went from Opel to France. Sales manager, came back to Opel, this is after I left, came back to Opel as sales manager there. And then from there he went to BMW, and he had some position there under the managing director, but higher. From there he went to Ford and became president of Ford of Germany, president of back to Germany, back to Ford here, to Chrysler.
That's dangerous.
Now he's used this all up. He's from the motorsport of Europe.
He's on his last company.
Never say that about Bob.
Oh, he'll survive somehow.
Oh, I think he's headed for
great thing.
Iacobus.
Yeah, certainly will.
But he's a pretty forceful guy.
Is there substance there?
Yes, I think there is.
So he's all the cleverness and that ability.
I think he did some very neat things when he was in Ford of Europe. His picture would always appear in the papers riding a motorcycle or driving a race car. You know, he's always doing those daring things, which he really likes to do.
Yeah.
And it makes tremendous copy.
It ruffles some feathers, though, I'm
sure.
Sure.
Well, he ruffled Henry's feathers.
Right.
One of
the things.
But that isn't hard to do.
No, not in those days. Well, so Bill said, Claire or Mac, he said this is...
I'd like to say one more thing before we get there.
Yeah.
I don't want to forget Bill's input into the GT.
Good.
And
yes.
Other projects.
Yeah, yes.
Because I was in constant touch with Bill on the telephone, and he would do a great job of telling people over here in this country what we were doing and how important the GT was, and to help us out when the top people I'm talking about.
Yeah, right.
I'm talking about the Knutsons and the Donners and so on, to help us out when they go over because we're in a little trouble on something.
Sure.
And Bill appreciates those things.
And he was your constant supporter.
Yeah.
Especially the GT. That was right at his house.
It's one thing I've got to say about Bill. Always throughout any of my career with him, he's always pushed for the new thing, and he's left me free to do everything I wanted to do, unless I differ from him in a major way. But that's while I was in Germany and after I came back. He has left me a lot of latitude, and that's what I call being a leader.
Yes. Oh, that's best part of being there.
You know, you don't want to tell somebody exactly do this and that and that and that. And Cole wouldn't do that, and Bill doesn't do that.
So under those two, you flowered.
Well, the things that were accomplished couldn't have been accomplished any other way.
Yeah, right. Unusual in a way. Other areas have been pretty straight-laced, and other companies with
Well, Bill can be that way too, but...
With you, he wasn't.
Well, sometimes he was.
Yeah. But in college, he was under.
Yeah. And you have to kind of know when to discuss things, too.
I suspect you were a very good diplomat.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah. And low-key, you know when to be forceful and when to stay back. On the whole, your assessment of your tenure at Rudolstein is good. Without being immodest, you think you did a good job.
Yeah,
you certainly brought them out of the door.
Yeah, I think a lot of good things happened.
Yeah.
And maybe it was the times, maybe it was the economy that helped along.
So it didn't hinder.
Yeah.
You were there at the right time, you were the right person. The right
but if we hadn't had somewhere near the right products, it wouldn't have been as good. And there were a lot of people that were helping create these products, other than our own department. We had some top-notch people in manufacturing and engineering that helped a great deal.
Now, Opel, since you've left, how's it fared? Is it still the European? I think it's the European style leader. Certainly, nothing comparable. Vauxhall is nothing comparable. To Opel.
No.
Yeah.
No. As a matter of fact, Vauxhall deteriorated somewhat for some reason, and it's at the point now where Opel provides them with the
input.
Designs and the engineering, and
pretty much become a satellite.
A lot of their cars are Opel cars assembled in England, and as result, their sales are going up.
Folks, Boxfall Bank, it's a good comeback.
Yeah, that's what I understand.
For a lot of money.
Yeah, but for some reason or other, the English people don't know how to build cars.
Well,
they have that reputation.
I think you found what other companies have found, that the Germans are marvelous technicians and good engineers, and they have the mechanical know-how that other cultures do not.
Well, Japanese are pretty good, too.
Oh, yeah, they're good, but I mean, that's they learn.
Japanese learn from everybody.
Yeah,
they learn from us, and they learn from the Germans.
Right.
They're very good learners.
Yeah.
Too good.
So, you weren't surprised when Bill said that it's time to come back.
No, I was at the point where our family was at the point where,
I wanted to ask you how they assimilated. How did the family make out during their 5 years? Kids learn the language?
Somewhat. We were in a community of Opal people. There were five houses, which we laughingly call the Opal Ghetto. But there was a managing director and manufacturing manager and the manager of finance, and a couple other houses that fluctuated between other people.
And one of yours.
And they all lived in this one nice little compound. It was lovely houses and yards and really great. And I could look out in my backyard and see a castle that was built in the 900s. It had been knocked down and built up in several wars. Wonderful place.
Did you like Germany?
Like German.
And you like the German people?
Like the German people.
How did your wife react? Did she assimilate fairly well?
Yes, it was difficult because, I could go to a place every day.
Yeah.
And it was easier for them to speak English to me than for me to speak German. My German is very bad, almost non-existent. But I understood more than I spoke. But she had to deal with the
shopkeepers.
Right. So she had to go down every day and buy groceries. And that's a little difficult. She had a little tough time. They got along.
How about the kids?
The kids were fine. They treated them very well.
They went to
military school in Wiesbaden.
Oh, really?
So Opal would send a driver to our home every morning, pick the kids up, run them down to Wiesbaden, 20 miles, pick them up at night, bring them back. And today, it's a little different. They have an international school, which is closer. Buses. So any kids that go over there today have that convenience. There were none of those things at the time we went over. And so our kids went to school in Wiesbaden for the 5.5 years we were there. And the military kids are great because they are moved so much. They're used to people coming in.
Right.
They make friends easily.
Very easy, yeah. Out of necessity.
Yeah.
Perfect. So
they got along fine.
They pick up on German customs or German sports, like soccer?
Not too much. It's pretty much an American community over there. Going to the American schools, if they'd gone to the international school, it would have been a little different. Although those are largely American students, but they're German students.
Right. Yeah.
Arab and Indian.
Oh, I see. When you say military school, this was children of military personnel.
Yeah, yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, were you sorry to leave?
Of course.
Of course.
My wife cried when she came. She cried when she went.
But for different reasons.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was at the same time. It was nice to come back.
What did Bill offer you?
When I came back, he offered the following position. It was set before I came back. I was executive in charge of all advanced design and engineering, and also I had under my wing all overseas design.
Wonderful.
So I
marvelous setup.
And he pretty much left me on my own.
Correct.
So that was fine.
It wasn't a paper position. It's actually something that you
really I think every position is really what you make of it.
Well, true.
So,
what resources did you put at your disposal?
All the manpower I needed.
Mm-hmm.
In the place.
And you had pass on to create and pass on all overseas design as well?
That was somewhat limited because, after all, the overseas places have their own management.
Okay.
But I was sort of acting in Bill's place.
Okay.
And having a lot of the influence that he would normally have.
As his deputy.
Yeah. But I didn't interfere too much with what they were doing because they have their own needs. And I understood this by this time. When I first went to Germany, I didn't understand a lot of their needs.
Mm-hmm.
So that caused a little brouhaha. But by this time, I understood. And that's part of the great thing that this overseas stint does for people.
Oh, must be great.
That is, after I was there, there was Chuck Jordan, Dave Holes, Haga, and now Wayne Cherry.
That's right.
And there was Brown before him, after Hank Haga was his first name. But anyway, he had a sad ending. He fell off the cliff. I think it was there before.
Oh, I see. Brown.
So Wayne Cherry took over. And Wayne Cherry has a world of experience at Vauxhall.
Oh, he had. Okay, so he moved in there.
And Ferdy Beichler, Ferdinand Beichler, was managing director at Vauxhall. He's a German.
Uh-huh.
And he was managing director at Vauxhall and knew Wayne Cherry there. Then Ferdinand Beichler came back to Opel as managing director. And he wanted Cherry back in Germany, so he brought
him. Can you spell Beichler's name?
B-E-I-C-K-L-E-R.
And Ferdinand?
Ferdinand.
F-E-R.
Ferdy, they call him.
Ferdy.
And he is now head of GM of Europe, which is situated in Switzerland. In other words, they control all of the European operations.
The GM of Europe office is now in Switzerland?
That may not be the name that they use.
What city? Geneva, Basel.
It's probably Basel.
Basel, yeah. Good candidate.
Anyway.
There was one notable, as you know, there was one notable refusal on this line to go to.
No, I think that was probably before I went.
Before
I think,
went?
I think he was asked.
I see.
Bill asked him first, and he refused. And I didn't understand that.
You never said neither did Bill.
But apparently, I don't know why he refused.
Maybe family problems.
It might have been. He was having some.
There's an innocence.
Well, I think he was having some marital problems.
Marital problems
at that time.
But
maybe he didn't like it. Maybe he thought his best opportunity to get that job was to stay here. I don't know what was in his thinking.
Yeah.
I'm glad he did.
Gosh, yes, it turned out beautifully for you. And of course, after your tenure, they were lining up. Presumably, you had no trouble asking Jordan and Holmes to go because they realized that there was an opportunity to broaden their horizons that they wouldn't have had otherwise.
Yeah.
And Haga, too, I think.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I know Haga and Holes were both anxious to go over there. Because during the time I spent and they spent in Europe, you're free of
all restraints. Or not all restraints, but all
90%.
Yeah, that you get in the States.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you're a Bill Mitchell over there.
Right, exactly. Perfect. Did that continue for Jordan and Holes?
Oh sure.
Yeah.
Although, I guess I was the only one. I was a director of Opel. I was named a director of Opel, and I don't think any of the others ever were.
That gave you a special
cachet
that you wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah. Because there's something about that
especially
that creates respect among all the German people.
They respect this, the authority that they gave you. Yeah. Interesting. How'd they come about? Was that offered as one of the original parts of the package?
No, that was done a couple of years into my time over there.
Okay. director felt it would be?
Ralph Mason was my managing director by this time.
Mr. Stark had moved on.
Mr. Stark had moved on, and Mason had become the managing director, and I guess I must have dropped a couple of hints to him, and he must have talked to somebody.
So you're in there. Mason had come over to the States.
Yeah, he was in manufacturing. With Chevrolet.
Mm-hmm. So you'd known him?
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd ever met him before he came over, but he was a fine fellow.
Very supportive.
Yes, and he did know more about the business than Nelson Stark.
Yes, right.
But he never interfered with anything that I was doing.
Product plan.
We didn't know about product planners. Even then.
Even
I didn't learn about product planners until I came back to this country.
Well, it was a dream assignment, but when you got back, that things changed.
Over here?
Yeah.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, what had happened? Were they to your liking, or did you find them?
Well, everything was fine with me. I had my own job to do.
And you got another dream assignment.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Well, along with the overseas thing, which kept me traveling around the world occasionally, and that was kind of nice, we got in about 1970, and I had a couple of guys working for me that were really top-notch people, and we got into a new project, which we called TASC, Total Automotive Systems Concept, and this involved making new lines of cars worldwide, which were simplified over the old way of doing things, because we started to look at the number of engines, the number of transmissions, the number of, this is not styling, this is more engineering, and the number of components. Every division throughout the world is making their own things, and not using what anybody else is making, so we wondered, well, why can't somehow we commonize and build fewer numbers, because there are a lot of 2-liter engines and 3-liter engines, 1.5-liter engines being built, but so many of them are different. So we made enormous big lists of all of these components, and then how we would suggest that they reduce them. Well, this is not really our business, but we did it anyway, and Bill Mitchell was supportive of what we were doing. He backed us. And we had all of the top people come out to look at it. I remember when Tom Murphy came out. He was not yet chairman. Forgotten just what his job was, but he was close. He was going there. We knew that he was going there.
Yeah.
And he looked at all this stuff. And you know, it took an hour or more of his time to do this. And we see these hundreds of different components that could be congealed down into a fewer number. And he looked at it and he shook his head and he said, gee, I don't know if we can afford, if General Motors can afford to do this. But we can't afford not to. And I thought that was a good statement.
Yeah. Very forward looking.
And I think they're trying to do something about this. It's hard to reduce the number of things being built throughout the world because they spend all kinds of money creating them and you can't just wipe them out, but attrition will help you reduce it if you keep your mind. And they're doing it now because, for example, Vauxhall and Opel are getting together and things and it's happening in other places.
No more wasteful.
Yeah. The other thing that we got involved in was front-wheel drive. Now this was about 1971. We were the first ones in the corporation to consider front-wheel drive. And we, to promote this program, we showed what we could do if we went front-wheel drive on every size car, starting at the Chevette size to the Cadillac size, and how we could improve the breed of the car, we could reduce the weight, we could reduce the size, and how we would do it. By making full-size clay models that look good, and seating bucks, and drawings, and we would show this whole array of vehicles. And we showed these quite a few times to management. Management of divisions, management of top management. And, you know, at first, all they can see is we're making so much money on V8 engines. Why shouldn't we just build those forever? But you can't build those into the kind of cars I'm talking about. Everybody can't have a big V8 engine. You're going to have fours, you're going to have sixes.